You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Welcome to All Souls Forum. All Souls Forum is a broadcast of a public forum held every Sunday at 10 a.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut. And as always, the views expressed on this program are the views of the speakers alone and do not necessarily represent the views of KKFI, its board, staff, or volunteers. And now, All Souls Forum. We join the program in progress.
And in the aftermath of the war, the European folks got together. Oh, by the way, remember President Wilson? Do you remember what his 14 points were? At least in theory. 14 points, most of which said this ethnic group needs to have its own country. So, gee, my goodness, the Kurds look around and say, hey, we're going to get our own homeland. The Arabs are getting that peace. You know, the Greeks are getting this peace. We're going to get a homeland.
Didn't happen.
So, the land of the Kurds, Kurdistan, has been an aspirational homeland for the Kurds since the late 19th century and certainly in the early 20th century. Kurdish regional government, which is the northern part of Iraq right now, is as close as any Kurdish entity has ever come to being a real independent place where they could call Kurdistan their homeland. But there's a problem. Kurds would say, we need to unite all of the Kurds in one homeland. That makes sense, doesn't it? Aha, except if you remember those statistics, 50% are in this country, 13% are in that country, 12% are in somewhere else. Which of these countries do you think is going to willingly give up a piece of its territory to establish Kurdistan? Not going to happen. Closest thing we've got, of course, right now is Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdish regional government in northern Iraq. So what does this mean for us? Well, we as Americans, I think we can sort of look on, you know, that's over there, that's a problem over there, we don't have to worry about it, let them worry about it. I think that's very short-sighted. Remember, I am by at least my background is as an army officer. So when we sent troops into Iraq to assist, all right, we beat the snot out of Saddam Hussein, got it, but went back to sort of help the Iraqis rebuild a nation, basically from scratch. One of our strongest allies was the Kurdish regional area. They had been disadvantaged, let's say, by the Saddam Hussein government. So they looked around and said, this is our chance to get our own back. Kurds established essentially their own self-governing province in northern Iraq before we got there. But they want more terrain. They want their traditional lands. They want the significant cities in northern Iraq to be Kurdish. Saddam Hussein had kicked the Kurds out of Mosul, for example, and replaced them with his supporters. They wanted their land back. Right, so here we are. Who do we support? Well, we're trying, in a typical American way, we want to be friends with everybody. So we work with the Kurds. We work with the Sunni leaders. We try to support the Shi'i aspirations for political power, all of whom have been fighting each other for about 10, 20, 30 generations. And we wonder why it isn't working well. All right, so we ended up kind of doing our best to balance between these competing interests, but the Kurds were our strongest ally, in part because they had an organization, an internal organization, security forces, called the Peshmerga. Now, every Kurdish political party has an element it calls Peshmerga. Peshmerga, if I get the translation correctly from Kurdish, means literally those who fight. So if you are a Barzani, you have a security organization that you refer to as the Peshmerga. If you are a Talibani, you also have a Peshmerga, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Peshmerga unified organization is right now only really being born. So they are a military force in development. But, okay, let's talk a little bit about the different Kurdish regional government organizations. Here we are, we're gonna at least sort of theoretically put ourselves someplace north of Mosul. There are two political parties that you're gonna deal with, and they're not the Republicans and the Democrats. They're the KDP, and the PUK, and the Kurdish words I'm not even going to try and pronounce. But the Kurdish Democratic Party, party of Masoud Barzani, referred to generally as a center-rightist party, but they are critically called tribal, feudalistic, and aristocratic. Barzani, Barzani family. The Barzani leadership, if you're not one of us, you better be. We are your leaders, we are your tribal leaders. You do what we say, or you're not going to get the benefits of being part of this organization. And that's just one. Then there's the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which is a center-leftist party. Beginning to sound familiar? They split from the KDP in about 1975 over internal disagreements, specifically after the Iraqi government used poison gas on the Kurds. You can see why the Kurds and the central government in Iraq have not exactly gotten along. Jalal Talabani, who was the president of the Iraqi Republic after Saddam Hussein was deposed, he is a member of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. A few years after he became the vice president, became the president, the prime minister of Iraq accused him of treason and drove him into political exile. That's two, all right. And then you will hear about the PPK. PPK, those happen to be the Kurds living in southeastern. Well, that's an exaggeration. The PPK claims to represent those Kurds living in southeastern Turkey. About 10 years ago, under the previous Turkish government, the Kurds were given literally the right to have their own political party. Before that, Kurds were considered, if you were a Turk, you would call them mountain Arabs. They were denied they even existed. Kurdish language was illegal to use. There were no Kurdish schools. Kurdish history was kind of ignored. But in 1985, 1990, thereabouts sometime, the government in Turkey, then very secular, said, no, wait a minute, we gotta come to a relationship with the Kurds because they make pretty good segment of our population in southeast Turkey. So the Kurdish party was allowed. The Kurds sent representatives to the Kurdish, to the Turkish parliament, and things were going along fairly well until my friend Mr. Recep Tayyip Erdogan decided that no, he needed to be the autocrat of the Turks, and the Kurds were then sent back into their second, third class citizenship, and the terrorism against Turkey took on new life. The PPK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, one of their current leaders, a fellow by the name of Cemal Bayık, another is Bezeho. You don't have to remember these names, by the way. There's no test at the end. But they are nationalists. They claim to be socialists, and they are a left-wing party. The PPK was founded in about 1978, and has since that time led a militant opposition to the Turkish government in southeast Turkey. And if you're the Turkish government, if they're in opposition, what would you call them? Terrorists. Nice buzzword. That means that everybody says they're bad guys, right? So the European Union, I think we still consider them to be a terrorist organization. They are insurgents. They want to. This being a place of worship, I got to be careful about how I use my phraseology here. well, yeah. Okay. So the PPK are anxious to militarily get the Turkish government out of their area. They want an independent Kurdish republic, and they're willing to die to get it. Of course, this means that they're fighting left and right with the Turkish followers, and that area that the Kurds that refer to as Kurdistan, as you may have noticed when I talked about where they're located, that border region gives the PPK a pretty good avenue of escape. When they're pressed hard by the Turkish military, they can retreat across that very mountainous border into northern Iraq. Well, that's fine, except that creates a problem for the Kurds in northern Iraq. Because if you remember, Kurdistan, that part of northern Iraq, is one of the largest oil reserves in the region, in that mountainous region around that area. The Kurds control the oil. So they have this agreement in the constitution of Iraq that says, yes, we have the oil, and the Iraqi government, through the Ministry of Petroleum, will allow us to sell our oil, and then we will both share the profits. Except the sharing of the profits becomes an interesting question. You know, how much share do we get? How much share do the other guys get? Has not been settled yet, although the Kurds are living in kind of a balanced equilibrium with the Iraqi government. But Kurds being, among other things, pretty good businessmen and women, they're selling their oil in other places, including to the Turks. So the Turks, being pretty good business people as well, have realized that it's in their best economic interests to export the Kurdish oil. All right, this gets a little bit convoluted, so you're going to have to bear with me here. So here we have oil being pumped out of Iraqi Kurdistan. It goes into pipelines that go north into Turkey, which is, by the way, one of the places where the Kurds are fighting against the Turkish authorities. But that oil doesn't really care who owns it. So it's exported through Turkish pipelines. So the Kurds in the Kurdish autonomous region, illegally, if you look at it from the Iraqi government perspective, are selling oil to the Turks. And the Turks are paying the Kurds in the north for their oil, and they're not sharing that with the central government. So, all right, and you think we have trouble here in Kansas? So, but that's only two of the regional areas. We've got Kurds in southeast Turkey. We have Kurds in northern Iraq. And then we have the Kurds in Syria. Oh, yeah? Well, they're there, too. In the northeastern part of Syria, there is a sizable Kurdish community. These are the folks who were fighting against the Syrian central government up to a few about 6 weeks ago. And those are the folks that we had American military assistance folks working with in order to help defeat the forces of the Islamic State, to keep those folks that had been captured, to keep those Islamic State fighters imprisoned. And was it 5 weeks ago? 4 or 5 weeks ago, the administration said, we're going to pull our American forces out and we're not going to support those Kurdish folks in Syria anymore. They can go and do what they want. Which, of course, gives those folks living to the north, the Turks, an opportunity. Because the Turks look at the PYD as being part of the PPK. Terrorists, from their perspective. You know, if I had a diagram here, I tried to do this on the blackboard in one of my classes, using sort of a flow diagram and who's related to who. And once you get this very communal idea, it began to make no sense at all from a Western perspective. And okay, what about Iran? Well, there's a Kurdish population in Western Iran, too. I have some direct experience with Kurds in Western Iran because a long time ago, as a lieutenant, I was part of a mobile training team working with the Iranian Special Forces. And one thing happened to the other. We're having a field training exercise. I got injured. And there was this fellow that I identified as a Kurdish militiaman who helped, you know, take care of my inadvertent wound. So here we have Iran with its own Kurdish organizations. The Democratic Party of Iranian Kurdistan. The Kurdish Free Life Party. Oy vey. So Society of Revolutionary Toilers of Iranian Kurdistan. Three different political parties operating in Iran. Some of which don't pay too much attention to the Ayatollah and his government. So what do you make of all this? Who are the Kurds? Well, they identify as Kurds. They don't agree with each other, but they identify as with a larger Kurdish identity. They are an ethnic group. They are an identifiable linguistic group. They have an aspirational attachment to an area of the country, of the world they call Kurdistan, which of course is shared by at least four countries right now. So the chances of them coming up with anything other than some sort of limited autonomy is probably about close to zero. That doesn't stop them from fighting. That doesn't stop them from saying, we need Kurdistan. So, you could, if you walked out on the streets of Kansas City and ran into a Kurd, I would submit that you wouldn't be able to tell the Kurd from any other ethnic group that happens to have dark hair. Who are the Kurds? They've been in this long struggle from time immemorial, if you wish, to the present day. I think if I'm going to gaze into my crystal ball, I would say that the idea that there will be peace in that part of the Middle East, at least in the near term, I'm defining that in no specific timeline because, frankly, I have no idea, but I think the chances of there being a peaceful settlement of the Kurdish question is probably about zero, too. The treaties that ended the First World War, the first set of treaties promised the Kurds a homeland, but when they finally came to the final Treaty of Lucerne in 1922, somehow that idea got lost. The Kurds will continue to fight, politically or militarily. But I think their chances of actually ending up with a Kurdish homeland, per se, is extremely remote. So, That's the Kurds. That's their long struggle. And I hope I have confused the heck out of you.
And now, if you have questions, please come to the mic to ask your question. One question per person till everyone has had an opportunity to ask a question. And please, no speeches. And then we will have conversation time after 11 in the library. Gary has agreed to stay. And please speak clearly and into the microphone.
Thank you. That was very informative. I and most other people that observed this from afar have noticed that the military groups of the Kurds, or at least the ones that were involved with fighting ISIS, relied tremendously on women in their military, which is kind of unusual, in particularly in that part of the world. Women usually don't have that kind of status. So could you explain how the Kurds view women in their society?
I can give it a shot.
And please don't misunderstand. I'm not criticizing your question. But the idea that there is a single way that women are treated in the Middle East is kind of one of those stereotypical things that doesn't hold water once you dig into it. Now, if you happen to be living in Saudi Arabia, women are specifically required to cover themselves from head to foot. They are only given limited rights. There's a cultural reason for that. If you look at other places, that's not true. Among the Kurds, their women have been valued members of the society as individuals, probably for about 1,000 years. That doesn't mean that they are given the same kind of opportunities that their brothers would have. But it does mean that they are valued for what they bring to the table. If you go back into even Arab history, up until the 20th century, if you were a Bedouin living in the desert, whether it's in Syria or whether it's in Iraq or whether it's anywhere else, if you disregarded the labor of the females of your tribe or your family, you're shooting yourself in the foot. Well, once the Arabs discovered oil and became wealthy, they could adopt all these nifty things that they actually got from the Byzantines. Remember, I'm a historian. And the Byzantines, wealthy people that they were, figured that women could be sequestered. That's where the Arabs got the idea that you ought to protect your females, put them someplace in the back of the tent, back of the house, back of the case, of the estate, and keep them protected from society. Kurds have not really lived that way for at least, I said 1,000 years, that's probably an exaggeration, 700 years. Okay? So women in Kurdistan are significant players, not only in their military, but also in their economy. And that doesn't answer your question at all, but at least it approaches something. Okay? Sir?
Thanks for your talk. I know you're not a businessman, but I can't, and neither am I, but I can't help wondering why it's any of our business over there at all, since supposedly, according to our myths, we are not an imperial nation, and we're formed by revolution or war against an imperial power.
I've had this conversation with students in my international relations courses as well. I think you have to go back to our early history. The idea that we are the city on the hill, that we are an exceptional people because of our history, in the what that means for us, in certainly since World War II, has been if we break it, we are required to fix it. And fixing it means, from an American perspective, not necessarily an individual American perspective, but a cultural perspective, that means we have to ensure that your country, that which we broke, has a representative democracy, a presidential leadership, a bicameral legislature, a judiciary that's free and independent, all those things that we spent 200 years developing. So, you're right, we are not imperial in the sense that we want to take everything you've got and make it our own. From the perspective of, you know, hey, we know what we intend, right? We intend good things. Hey, we're the good guys. So we go out and we want to fix things, whether you're talking about Iraq or whether you're talking about Syria or whether you're talking about Central Africa. We want to fix things, and fixing things from our perspective means making them look kind of sort of like us, because we got it right, it works, and therefore we are the model. American exceptionalism. All right, now what we ignore, remember, I'm a historian, is that it took us probably 800 years of developing institutions in Europe on which we built our democracy. It's not one of those things you take the democracy box out of the refrigerator and you put in two drops of water and democracy springs to life full blown. But that's not the way we look at things. Remember our long-term plan. What's our long-term planning perspective in this country? 5? 2. Next week. Yeah. So we don't, as a fairly young country, we don't have the historic perspective to say it's going to take time. That's my intention, my perception of answering your question. Does that help at all? Okay. Yes, sir.
Is there any part that the State Department, the United States State Department, plays in any of this? Because usually you have like a relationship between, say, for instance, the United States and Italy. Okay, so an American citizen who was over there, there'd be some kind of a relationship that the State or a role of the State Department would play. But when you're talking about four countries and a group that is not necessarily monolithic, how does now the State Department deal with any of this?
Very carefully. We have, from a State Department perspective, we have unilateral relations with each one of those countries. All right? We have an ambassador and embassy in Iraq. We have an ambassador and an embassy in Turkey. We had, past tense, an ambassador and an embassy in Iran, and the same was true in Damascus. All right? So we deal, from a State Department perspective, with countries on an individual basis. The State Department is organized into regional groups. And the one that has the predominant number of Middle Eastern countries happens to be the Bureau of Middle East and North Africa. All right, so they look regionally. Turkey, however, is not part of that group. Turkey is included in Europe because it's part of NATO. Ooh. So, I'm getting to your question, but understanding the framework is, I think, important. As a consular officer in Damascus, I had responsibility for the entire country. So some of my colleagues would be talking to the leaders of the Kurdish group in Eastern Syria. In fact, the fellow who eventually gave himself up, leader of the PKK,
PPK, sorry, who finally decided it was no longer worthwhile being insurgent. He surrendered to the security forces. It was a contact of one of my colleagues. We talk as a State Department Foreign Service officer. Our job is to go out and talk to the individuals, to the leaders, to the man on the street, to find out what's going on. Now, that's part of the problem, in that when we are in a situation where there are people actively shooting at us, consular officers, frankly, we don't like being shot at. Now, we don't mind being in an exciting place. Mind you, that's true. But when the bullets begin to fly, I'm wearing my, you know, my three-piece suit, it's not quite the same as an Army officer going out there with his helmet and his protective gear. When there is no security, or at least not a modicum of security, State Department representatives can't do their job. So, in Iraq, when the shooting was really bad, the State Department folks just were not allowed to leave the confines of the embassy. The ambassador said, I'm not going to put you at risk, you stay home. Which meant that the military ended up carrying the buckets for the State Department. Is that helping, sort of? But the State Department, in a situation where there is at least a limited degree of security, the State Department folks will get out there the minute they're allowed to try and reestablish contacts, get the economy working again, and do those kind of political development pieces that would lead, theoretically, to an improved society. One element of the State Department is the United States Agency for International Development. Works for the State Department, not really part of the State Department. But among their portfolio is political development, economic development, and things of that nature. So if we have a moderate degree of security, folks from USAID would be out there in a heartbeat. Because we're Americans and we want to fix things. And one of the ways we fix things is by developing institutions. Long involved answer. Does that help at all? Yes, sir.
Hi. Hi. I've had a curiosity about two things about this mid-east. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Did you hear them? Hi. Okay, speak up. No. I'll just talk right here.
All right.
I got two questions for nobody moan. The first one could be a one-word answer. Number one, are the Kurds Muslim? Are the Kurds Muslim? Yes or no?
Not all of them.
Okay, that's that. Second thing I've always been curious about is, it's in World War I, which you brought up a while ago. From my understanding, which is limited, the British basically cut the Middle East up into different countries. I don't argue about that right now. The reason I'm curious, why I'm curious about specifically is, why did the British, whoever was in charge, divide up the Middle East as they did with different countries and leave out the Kurds?
Oh, dear. During the great unpleasantness that we've called the First World War, if you look at it, I mean, don't look at it from the outcome, but look at it from the beginning. Around 1915, the British, the French, and the Russians, they're losing their shirts. So the British, the French, and the Russians were seeking for allies and agreements and solutions everywhere they could find them. The French, British, and the Russians, I include the Russians because up until 1917, remember the Russians were part of that Grand Alliance. The French, the British, and the Russians got together and said, well, you know, we're going to win this eventually. And after the war is over, how are we going to divide up all these conquered territories? Because that's what European winners did. 18th century, 19th century. It was tradition, you know. I win, I get all the terrain. So they came to this conclusion that, well, we're going to beat the snot out of the Ottomans, so therefore we're going to divide up the Ottoman possessions as follows. Okay, Russia, you're going to get this piece, you're going to get access to the warm water ports on the Black Sea, which you've wanted for about 300 years. Okay, France, you have this special relation with the Maronites who live in what we now call Lebanon. It was then referred to just as Mount Lebanon. So since you have that relationship, we're going to allow you to have that piece of the Mediterranean coastline that's got Mount Lebanon and some inland part of that. Okay, that's great. Great Britain, you're having this relationship with the Arabs down south. So you get this southern part of this thing. Oh, shucks, wait a minute. We've got this piece over there around the Tigris-Euphrates River. How are we going to deal with that? Well, Great Britain says, well, it's all right. We are going to need the oil for our fleet, which we have just converted from coal to fuel oil. So we want this piece that has all the oil wells. Ah, fine, no problem. Well, that entire agreement resulted in the straight lines you see on the map. Anytime you see, I'm a historian here, anytime you see a straight line on that borders two countries and they have this straight, this razor edge line that says theirs is mine and I'm theirs, you can damn well be sure that it was done on a conference table somewhere other than in the land where that was being done. It's easy to put this line on the map. Okay, fine, great. What happens? Well, you separate tribal areas, you separate ethnic groups. My traditional place that I used to go to sell my whatever I'm selling is over here. It's now on that other country. Oh, dear. The French and the British and the Russians, who lost out because the Bolsheviks disavowed any relationship to this thing, they drew these lines based solely on their perceived interests. Which actually, if you think of it from the perspective of just having defeated the Ottomans, probably makes a lot of sense. Now, where were the Americans in all this? Well, we were the junior partner. President Wilson sent a group of experts to the Middle East to figure out who the people wanted to work with. And the results of this thing, investigation were that the people that they talked to, which tended to be the educated elites in places like Damascus and Baghdad, didn't want to be part of the European alliance system. They didn't want to belong to the Brits or the French or anybody else. And if they had to belong to somebody, they would much rather have the Americans be the rulers. How's that going to go over in the Senate in 1918? So, the Sykes-Picot Treaty, which has given a lot of bad publicity, divided the Ottoman possessions among the winners based on their perceived interests, and creates the confusion that we have today. Now, what the actual process was, every Ottoman city was considered to be kind of like a province. So there was a province that was centered on Damascus. There was a province that was centered on Mosul. There was a province that was centered on Basra. But Mosul and Basra and Baghdad ended up in British hands under their mandate. Damascus was part of the French mandate. But where had the folks in Mosul, where had they normally traded? East and west, not north and south. Where had the folks in Basra normally done business? With the Gulf, south. They were maritime people. They didn't want to belong to Baghdad. They didn't want to have anything to do with Mosul. Those are those, you know, backwoods guys up in the north. So the decisions to carve the Middle East into the countries that we see today had nothing to do with business, had nothing to do with ethnic, had nothing to do with anything else other than perceived European interests. And we live with that now. Be careful what you pray for. You're going to get it. They prayed for that dividing up the Middle East, and that's what they got. And there's not a darn thing we can do about it now, in my opinion. Hi, ma'am.
I see a, and I've felt this strange feelings that what happened when we went into Vietnam could happen again.
History doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. No, I think you've got a good point. All right, side story here. It has nothing to do with your question. I think one of the reasons, and I'm old enough to have been at least a Vietnam era veteran. I never went to Vietnam, but I was part of that generation of officers who felt the disdain from, look around, your generation. You know, when officers and soldiers got off the plane in San Francisco or San Diego or wherever it was, and they were berated, accosted, spit upon. I was at least part of that generation. And now, what, 70 years, 60 years later, you know, people are saying, hey, glad for your service. In part, I think that's a recognition that we did not treat our soldiers very well when they came back from a deployment, that they had no authority to say I wasn't going. Soldiers do what they do because they love this country. Now I'm getting emotional. And my students now, I tell them what happened to us as soldiers in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And the broken army, and the things, the problems we had with the army in that time period. And they have, I mean, it's like you're talking about life on Mars. They have no way, they can't conceive of that situation. So, I think, in getting back to your question, the difference between what we're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq in comparison to Vietnam is, first, we have not had the massive number of soldiers involved in either of those places. That has been good and bad. It has been good in the sense that the American, we could afford it. We're rich. We can spend $13 billion in Afghanistan. Yeah, we can argue about that. But we spent lives in Vietnam, 56,000. We haven't had that kind of a blood cost in Afghanistan or Iraq. So that's a difference. We fought in Vietnam because we were convinced that we were defeating communism, and if we didn't defeat communism in East Asia, it would be on the doorsteps of Peoria in another couple of years. Now, that may have been a totally misguided perception, but that was where most of you are old enough to remember the fact that the Soviet Union was the existential threat. If we didn't defeat the Soviets here, or the Red Chinese there, you know, they were going to take over the world. That's not so in the background of Afghanistan or Iraq. We invaded Iraq as a follow-on to Desert Shield and Desert Storm because we agreed with the president that naked aggression cannot stand unchallenged. And we've been successful. And we freed Kuwait. By the way, Kuwaitis will be, I think, at least for the next five or six generations, eternally grateful for us for doing that. We got involved in Iraq because the son of a bitch in Baghdad was a bloodthirsty thug. And I argued with some of my State Department friends that if you knew anything about Saddam Hussein, no further justification of our actions against Baghdad were needed. If you didn't understand Saddam Hussein, no justification of our actions against Baghdad were even permissible. I'm sorry, I've wandered away from your question. But that's me. As I tell my international relations students, it's my course, I'll wander where I want. And this looks like I'm being given the yank off the stage. Thank you. I've enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
So Gary will be available for a few minutes, 20, 30 minutes down the library, which is on your left as you exit you turn left as you exit and it's on your right. Next week's speaker will be Elisa Kennedy, who will be speaking about working together for Kansas City. And you are welcome to stay for the 11:15 service.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only and not necessarily those of Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
Hi, this is Mark Manning. I host Wednesday Midday Medley here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, every Wednesday from 10 to noon. And actually, my work in community radio was inspired by my work in community gardens. And in 1999, I began work with the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens, where a program that came out of the University of Kansas Medical Center's Office of Cultural Enhancement and Inclusion. And they do a K-12 initiative with a Saturday Science Academy and a Summer Science Academy. And through that work, we created an organic teaching garden program in three middle schools and four elementary schools in Kansas City, Kansas, where we have built raised bed organic gardens right on the school grounds of these schools. And students in first, fourth, and sixth grade are involved in planting and harvesting spring gardens, summer gardens, and fall gardens every year through their schools. We have developed a curriculum of workshops that we operate September through June in 27 different classrooms, working with 1,300 different students. We do about 50 workshops a month, ranging in teaching students about organic gardening, about soil and worms and worm composting, about the parts of the plant and the parts of a seed. We do a salsa workshop, which brings together different cultures to tell the story of salsa, the music, the dance, and the sauce. One of our biggest crops that we grow in all of our gardens are organic sweet potatoes. And so we do a whole sweet potato workshop through the month of November, where we talk about the history of the sweet potato and George Washington Carver, and we cook the sweet potatoes that the students have actually planted, grown, and harvested in our gardens. We then make sweet potato fries for all of our students. We just recently completed workshops for 1,300 students where we served over 1,500 orders of sweet potato fries while we did the workshop. We've collaborated with a number of different organizations in Kansas City, and the whole purpose of this is to connect students to food and where does food really come from and how easily it is that we can grow our own food. If we teach people how to grow their own food, they'll never go hungry. They'll always be able to know that they can grow that food themselves. And through our work, we have reached over 10,000 students. And every year, our program donates back into the community between $7,000 and $10,000 worth of organic food that we grow in our gardens, whether it be lettuce, radish, spinach, sweet potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, carrots, all of the great things that we grow in our gardens, which are grown right on the school grounds of these public schools in Kansas City. The school program connects literature, science, math, history. Basically, you can teach about anything through a garden. And that's kind of what we've tried to do for the past 20 years with this program, which has been funded all these years through grants and through gifts from people who've donated to bring these as a gift into the public schools that we serve. The program is called the KCK Organic Teaching Gardens. We serve 1,300 students each year in first, fourth, and sixth grades at seven different schools, collaborating with nearly 30 teachers. And my name is Mark Manning, and this has been Community Voices, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Margo Patterson, and I'm a member of Code Pink KC. Code Pink works to end the United States' many wars and to call attention to the costs of U.S. militarism, the human costs borne by those abroad who become the victims of those wars, and the financial costs borne by the American public. The United States spends more on its military budget than the combined military budgets of China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, India, France, the United Kingdom, and Germany. Code Pink advocates for redirecting those dollars to education, healthcare, infrastructure, and green new jobs. The organization was founded in the fall of 2002 to prevent the U.S. war in Iraq. Medea Benjamin, Jody Evans, and about 100 other women set up a four-month, all-day vigil in front of the White House during the cold of winter. Many organizations joined in, and over 10,000 people participated. The name Code Pink plays on the former Bush administration's color-coded Homeland Security alerts, yellow, orange, and red, that signal terrorist threats. Code Pink since then has become known for its creative tactics, which include street theater, creative visuals, satire, civil resistance, and directly challenging powerful decision makers. Code Pink opposes torture, the detention center at Guantanamo, weaponized drones, the continuing U.S. war in Afghanistan, U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen, now considered the world's greatest humanitarian disasters. Code Pink KC started this past spring after a visit by Medea Benjamin, who spoke at a KKFI fundraiser. We meet the fourth Tuesday of the month at 5:30 at XY Restaurant's Coffee Bar at 55th and Brookside Boulevard in Kansas City, Missouri. We are looking for new members. Contact us at codepinkkc@att.net. This is Margo Patterson, and I'm with Community Voices on KKFI Radio.
So my name's David Bayard, and I was a woodworker. I still am a woodworker, then became a photographer, and then at some point got into poetry, which I've been doing about 30 years. A lot of people say they don't like poetry. And I'm always curious why. And then they say, well, I don't get poetry. And it's like, well, some of it I don't get either. And I think what the problem is that poetry by its nature is describing the mysterious. And to do that, it uses language that might sound like the same words you and I use all the time, but really it can come out pretty mysterious because you are doing something that cannot be explained quite as well in any other method, prose, you know, so forth. And one of my friends who was a musician says, well, I write songs. And as well, those are poems. But poetry describes things that cannot be grasped. So, and I think that's, people don't like poetry because, A, they don't get it. That's the nature of poetry, but good poetry can be gotten. It might take you two or three readings. I listen to Van Morrison's poetry, and sometimes it takes 10 readings. And after the 10th reading, I go, I get it. I get it. And there's this epiphany where I understand, and I go back and listen to the rest of the song, and it's like, yep, yep, that's what he's talking about. That's what he's talking about. I'm going to read a poem here, but before I do, I want to say to your listeners, write your own stuff. Try writing your own stuff. And a good way to start is to journal. Just take a journal and just write down in the mornings, for example, write down whatever comes to mind. And the act of doing that will free your mind, you know, from the day-to-day, and you'll drop into a deeper place where you can see what's going on underneath all of this other stuff. The poem I'm going to read is called Runes. Picture yourself on the cold waters of the North Atlantic, fighting another tyrant from another time, the French, Mr. Napoleon. And you're out there on the seas in your ship. You've lost half your men. The lucky ones were those who were dead when they hit the water. But you can't stop and pick the rest of them up because the French are coming back around and you need to be ready when they come. This is called Runes. The ancient stones portray their runes upon the gentle sand and gather in tall tales of ships and sailors as they wash up on the tide and present themselves to land. On their weathered faces grows a wisdom which is whispered on the ceaseless winds. We could do more, they say, but all that can be pulled away is at the bottom of the sea. Think not, thou brief ephemeral skins, that they are lost, for nothing that exists is without our memory. Nothing that exists is without our memory. Sing and dance upon the deck. Sing and dance upon the deck and challenge just as once supremacy. For all is hope and all is pain, mixing endlessly in rhythms great and small. The cold blue sea will seize you in its warm embrace. For you cannot be lost, no matter how storm-tossed. The end is the beginning, which you never really left, but still are gathered up within our sleeve. You still are gathered up within our sleeve. Your trials have a purpose far beyond the ones you give them. Those who will allow a mystery. We've watched you and have loved you, and you've given back, you see. Your trick of sowing love within each other shall be gift enough for thee. There's no need to thank us or to praise us. Just to be. Just to be.
This has been Community Voices on KKFI Radio. Thank you for tuning in to All Souls Forum. Keep your dial tuned right here for American Roots with Nick Spitzer and Classical Challenge with Dr. Mike and Mark Andrus right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.